It has become crystal clear that the sanctions imposed by the USA on Syria are punitive measures that specifically target the Syrian people, children, women, old men, and young adults, with no exception for the sick or hungry children, or those trapped under the rubble of an earthquake, or the millions who now sleep out in the open in harsh weather conditions. The human tragedy that resulted from the catastrophic earthquake in Turkey and Syria is expanding because of the huge loss of life and property. However, it is crucially important at this stage for all countries of the world, specifically the Islamic nation, to collaborate to help the two peoples overcome the effects of the catastrophe and heal the wounds of the tragedy, especially the Syrian people. This is crucial given the lack of capabilities of the Syrian state to carry out operations to rescue the victims, secure those afflicted, and rebuild due to continuous international crimes committed against Syria, incited by the Zionist entity and its leadership in the United States of America. The philosophy of the American arrogance is the framework surrounding the crime committed against Syria. The crime took various forms, beginning and ending with sanctions, passing through siege and looting, continuing with strife and wars, and attempts at disintegration and division. Encompassing all these crimes is the highest interest of the Zionist entity. The entity that airdropped humanitarian aid, especially packed for tragedy-stricken Syria in the form of bombs and missiles, sent only 13 days after the greatest natural disaster that hit Syria in more than 100 years. The special Zionist package of death killed 5 civilians and wounded 20 others after targeting a residential area in the capital, Damascus. Has any other nation in modern history endured so far what Syria has? Despite Syria overcoming most of the challenge of the global war directed by Zionists and Americans against it, especially the danger of dividing the people and the land, in came the illegal Caesar's Act to complement the global Zionist Western war on Syria in an attempt to accomplish what the war failed to achieve by overthrowing the Syrian state. This hindered the Syrian state's capabilities from dealing with the earthquake disaster and at some point crippled the government institutions, impeding them from reaching certain stricken areas devastated by the disaster. All the while, the U.S. has been actively depriving Syria of its oil resources and agricultural lands looted by the Americans, destroying the bulk of its economic assets. This crime, which brought Syria to this disastrous situation through sanctions, siege, war, and looting, is what exacerbated and multiplied the earthquake catastrophe, and even made the U.S. crime committed against it with intent and persistence more dangerous than the natural disaster that hit the war-torn country. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Can overcome the disaster of the earthquake with its own capabilities and the support of its friends. But it will certainly overcome it effectively and quickly, along with all its internal crises, when the crime committed against it under American leadership and Zionist incitement stops. The crime took various forms, beginning and ending with sanctions, passing through siege and looting, continued with strife and wars and attempts to disintegrate Syria and divide it. The crime is governed by the philosophy of American arrogance as a framework, and its compass is the interest of the Zionist entity as a final goal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, author, academic, and managing editor of the Contemporary Arab Affairs Journal. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Wakim. Now, the lack of capabilities that was master of the scene inside Syria after the devastating earthquake results from a continuous international crime against Syria instigated by the Zionist entity and the U.S. regime, while just less than 2 weeks later, after the earthquake, we saw the Zionist entity dropping bombs on the heads of the Syrians sleeping in the comfort of their homes, of their houses in Damascus just 3 days ago. Is there a real way out for Syria from this?
Too bad. I believe that Syria will keep suffering from this situation as long as the United States is trying to destabilize the country, trying to support some separatists in northeast Syria, mainly the Qasad Kurds, and in an attempt to redraw the whole geopolitical map of the region, including Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, based on confessional and ethnic lines. So that's why I believe that the United States didn't care much about the earthquake that happened, but saw it as an opportunity to further weaken Syria, to further try to destroy it, because what has been done by the earthquake was been done by the United States over the past 13 years now, alongside the Zionist entity. So an added evidence is the latest Israeli strike against civilians, peaceful civilians in Damascus. I believe that too bad we don't have a way out so far.
Well, the aim of the United States imposed sanctions on Syria is basically to subjugate the people, the regime and the state and the institutions of the state as well to the will of the U.S. foreign policy. And this has been the game since the beginning of the war in 2011. So far, this has failed. Will this devastating earthquake break the will of the Syrian people this time?
I don't believe so, because the Syrians have been resilient over the past 13 years. They have been supporting, the majority of them, of course, they have been supporting their government against the attempts to destabilize it, to destabilize the country and to divide it into various states and sub-states. I believe that they will keep fighting, and they are benefiting from the support of their allies and some Arab brothers, including, for example, the support that came from Iran, Russia, Iraq, Algeria, Lebanon, and other Arab states. Not many Arab states abstentiated from giving support, but I'm talking about many Arab states that did actually send support to Syria. And Syria will benefit from this to further resist the U.S. attempts to weaken it and to bring the country to its knees.
Well, Dr. Joachim, the most important impact of U.S. sanctions on Syria was depriving it of its oil resources and of the agricultural lands as well in the northeastern part of the country, which was stolen by the Americans by destroying the bulk of what economy Syria has left and transforming it into a country that was once self-sufficient into a country that is always dependent on others to in basic needs of food, medicine, supplies, oil. So this brings the question of direct resistance against the actual physical U.S. occupation inside Syria, especially in the eastern part of the Euphrates. Is Syria in a state that would allow it to pursue such a resistance against an occupation that's already there?
I believe that the Syrians are preparing themselves for such a development. However, for the time being, I don't believe that it's within the capability of the Syrian government to support an armed resistance against the American occupation in northeast Syria. The Syrian government is trying to appease the Kurdish separatists there in order to draw them into dialogue with the government, and this is a mean for them to contain the situation. That's why they are refraining from supporting armed struggle in northeast Syria. But eventually, if the Americans persist in their occupation of this region, if they persist in supporting the separatists in their aim to divide Syria, I believe that it's out of question for the Syrians not to launch a war of resistance against this occupation.
Well, but lastly, Dr. Joachim, what the Western mainstream media is propagating on its platforms is that the U.S. has, in fact, effectively removed and lifted the sanctions of Syria for it to allow for aid to help. But you know, as much as I know, that this is not the case because the Syrian banking system is still not working. People cannot wire money to Syria to help their families and their friends. So what was that announcement about, and what will it take for the U.S. to actually ease those sanctions?
Well, the U.S. made this declaration, which is a false declaration because it didn't get implemented on ground, but because they were forced to make this declaration because they were faced by a wave of indictment by the majority of the countries in the world and the majority of the people in the world. Because the American government saw itself embarrassed, and that's why it made such a vocal declaration void of any essence, actually, because as you mentioned, the banking system in Syria is still under sanctions. The Americans are still pressuring the separatist Kurds in northeast Syria not to allow aid to cross from the regions that they dominate into the government-dominated regions. There are other, sanctions that are still in place. So that's why I believe that what the Americans did was a PR, move in order to avoid embarrassment, especially after this wave of indictment by the majority of the peoples around the world.
So in less than a minute, Dr. Joachim, do you think that the help that Syria got from the states that actually broke the Caesars Act within hours from the earthquake would be sufficient for it to try and at least reconstruct what the earthquake broke?
Too bad, despite the generous aid coming from friendly and brotherly countries to Syria, like Iran, Iraq, Russia, Lebanon, Jordan, Algeria, etc. However, this aid is short of helping the government restructure the whole economy, especially that it's still passing through a state of war imposed on it by the United States and the Zionist entity. So this will be short of helping Syria achieve its aim in reconstructing the country. We need more aid, we need more lavish donations and bilateral cooperation between Syria and other countries in order to be able to overcome this situation.
We actually do see that in the near future, because the people in Syria do need our help very much, and as soon as possible as well. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Jamal Joachim, author, academic, and managing editor of the Contemporary Arab Affairs Journal, for joining us to talk about this crucial matter. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about a new way that Israel has came up with for ethnic cleansing in Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The Israeli Knesset approved a new racist law to revoke citizenship and residency from Palestinian prisoners who carried out heroic operations against the occupation's army and its settlers who reside in the Palestinian territories of 1948 and occupied Al-Quds. Now, the law provides for the deportation of these prisoners from their hometowns immediately upon the end of their sentence to areas supposedly controlled by the Palestinian Authority. Let's see more details about this in this following report.
The Israeli Knesset has passed a law making it easier for authorities to revoke citizenship and residency from Palestinians imprisoned who carried out heroic operations against the occupation army and its settlers over what Israel designates as, quote, acts of terror, unquote. The final reading of the bill, which for the first time stipulates the deportation of Palestinians to the occupied territories, was passed last Wednesday afternoon by a vast majority of Knesset with 94 votes in support and just 10 against. This new racist law provides for the deportation of these prisoners from their hometowns immediately upon the end of their sentence to areas controlled by the Palestinian Authority. It is noticeable in the vote on this law that it came with a broad Israeli consensus among members of the government coalition and the Israeli opposition at the same time, and a dangerous indication of the dimensions of this law on the Palestinians in the occupied territories, as well as the unified Israeli position in targeting the Palestinian man, his identity, and his land. The danger of the timing of the law's adoption is that it came in an Israeli political environment that is witnessing disagreements and an escalation of the state of political tensions, conflicts, and real divisions, which reads that the Israeli occupation, when it comes to the Palestinians, they unite immediately. The targeting of this law goes beyond the issue of targeting the prisoners who carried out operations against the army of the occupation and its settlers. Rather, it is the beginning of a blatant and broad legitimization of a forced displacement and mass expulsion of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories. The implementation of this law paves the way for the withdrawal of nationality and residency to implement displacement and ethnic cleansing projects against the Palestinians, especially against the residents of Wadi Ara, which is a Palestinian village occupied since 1948, and the appropriate circumstances waiting for the passage of this decades-old project. The danger in the law is that it flouts international and humanitarian law, and the start of its application means that it will be applied retroactively against Palestinians who were previously arrested in Israeli prisons and receive salaries from the Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Authority as released prisoners as a crime, and their citizenship will be revoked and they will be forcibly displaced from their homes. The racist Israeli law is in stark contrast to international law, which prohibits the expulsion of any citizen from his homeland and country. It also forms the basis for political precautions and the excessive use of the emergency systems that the Israeli occupation entity inherited from the British Mandate, including movement restrictions, administrative detention and expulsion based on ethnicity and Palestinian nationality.
New ways by Israel to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian state and nation. With us to discuss this issue from the occupied Al-Quds is Dr. Mohammad Halassi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs. I want to thank you, Dr. Halassi, for being with us now. The seriousness of the timing of the adoption of the Israeli law requiring the withdrawal of citizenship and residency from Palestinian prisoners who carried out these heroic operations, it comes at a political moment in Israel where there is real division inside of the Israeli entity. So they fight over everything, but unanimously vote for expelling more native Palestinians from their lands. But why now, and what might be the repercussions of such a law?
This Israeli behavior is not limited to this decision taken by the Knesset of the occupation. Rather, Israel practiced such an act previously and in an effort by this government to implement its subjugation agenda. This is settler colonialism that did not come to coexist with the Palestinians. On the contrary, it came to replace it. In addition to the machine of oppression and force exercised by the armored vehicles and tanks, it also seeks, through the legislation it enacts, to expel the Palestinians. This law is in the service of the colonial system. When it comes to the Palestinians, the laws set by the occupation's Knesset comes to serve this colonial agenda, which ultimately aims to empty the Palestinian land of its inhabitants and replace them with the Zionist settlers. This comes, as you kindly pointed out, in light of the conditions of division experienced by Israeli society. However, this society, which shows signs of division and disintegration, comes together and unites completely from their far right to their far left when matters relate to the Palestinian rights. The Zionist left, which formed previous governments, has always watched the actions of the right towards the Palestinians and has never said a word. Now, when the Zionist far-right's fire bounces back internally on Israeli society, you see them demonstrating and shouting loudly to stop the far-right's advance and impose their internal agenda on the Israeli society. Yet, when it comes to the Palestinians, you see them unite and agree. When it comes to the Palestinians, they are one voice and one unit. This law comes to confirm the racism of this Israeli society and its unity to exclude the Palestinians. There is no difference in this society between its left, its center, and its far right. This law will inevitably backfire on the Israelis. The Israelis believe that imposing the logic of force and coercion on the Palestinians will bring security to its society. But experiences have shown that the more the Israeli coerce and penetrate with arrogance the Palestinian society, the more the Palestinians adhere to their rights, and the more these actions backfire on the Israelis, who will pay the price for their racism. We saw how the Palestinian society, with the natural reactions of its members, inflicted human losses on the Israeli society, causing it to lose security from a government that claimed that it was coming to impose security to protect the Israeli society.
Dr. Muhammad, the goal behind the law goes beyond the issue of targeting only the Palestinian prisoners. We all know how the Zionist entity thinks and the occupation thinks. Rather, it is just the beginning of a blatant and broad legitimization of forced displacement and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people in the occupied territories. That is basically the definition of what ethnic cleansing is. But who's to stop Israel from doing this? Let's say they did begin doing this. What can stop Israel from pursuing this?
Before this government, there were no Israeli governments that carried roses and brought peaceful stances towards the Palestinian people. On the contrary, all the governments that preceded this one were right-wing. We have experienced Sharon's government with his policy of breaking the bones of the Palestinians. We have seen many Israeli political leaders who left, their parties ended, their slogans ended, but Palestine remained, and the Palestinian people remained. Who stood and who will continue to stand in the face of these arrogant racist calls? Israel's problem is that it becomes blind in front of the issue of Palestinian national rights. It believes that this people has no history and that it had no national political entity. Israel wants to deal with Palestinians as mere human groups that can only have regular daily life demands, and does not want to recognize the right of this Palestinian people to their freedom and independence. As long as it deals with the Palestinians from a security angle, and as long as it views the Palestinians as a security threat, then the Israeli society will be enlightened in paying the bill for this blindness and disregard for the rights of an entire people. Israel is a manipulator who believes that the balance of power and the logic of force transcends its large military system and transcends the coverage it gets, unfortunately, from some Arab regimes. Israel is under the cover of the United States of America and international institutions, so it believes that the Palestinians can be broken. This is an issue that has always been shattered on the rock of the steadfastness of the Palestinians. This law will fall. The Palestinian prisoners and the Palestinian people will overthrow it with their steadfastness and their continued struggle, just as all previous racist laws have fallen. In this matter, we do not count on international bodies or international institutions. We count on the will of the Palestinian people.
This is exactly what I want to point out, Dr. Muhammad, is that despite the normalization that some of the Arab regimes have conducted with the Zionist entity, at least there must be some sort of a clear stance against such a law, which is basically an open law against ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. And yet we hear nothing. We didn't even hear a condemnation coming from them. I mean, at least a condemnation. Would you think there would be otherwise?
First of all, these Arab regimes have no free will to begin with. They are led under patronage of the American administration to sign peace agreements with Israel. They lack the political will and they do not rely on the popular will, which is completely contrary to the desires of the political regimes that see Israel as a friend. In terms of the international community, it is a hypocritical community. The European Union is a hypocritical union. The Western colonial international system is also a sponsor of this occupation, and it is the one that provides the Western and Arab regimes with reasons not to condemn Israel. We are accustomed to hypocritical behavior, and we have seen it previously in situations when Israel bombed Palestinian homes and killed our children and the elderly. When Israel implements its colonial destruction machine, we do not hear this system condemning this Israeli behavior and these Israeli actions. While when the armed Zionist settlers who attack the Palestinians are killed by the Palestinians who are defending themselves, we see how the cries of the Arab world rise and the cries of the international world rises. On top of which is the United States to condemn the Palestinian actions, which we consider to be self-defense. Unfortunately, we did not expect from the world other than this behavior of what we are familiar with. This world respects only the strong, and the Palestinians do not need condemnations. The Palestinians need actions from the international community. We need them only to subjugate Israel to abide by the law. Global behavior deals with Israel as a state above the law, allowing it to continue its aggression, racism, and legislation that it enacts, which are in violation of international laws legislated by the institutions of the international community. Yet, we see the world remaining silent in front of legislation that violates human dignity and human rights endorsed by this same international community.
Definitely. Which is why, Dr. Mohammed, we believe in the resistance of the Palestinian people and their right for a full-armed resistance against this occupation and its aggression and its blatant ethnic cleansing against the people of Palestine. I want to thank you very much from Occupied Al-Quds, Dr. Mohammed Hellasi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter. Dear ladies and gents, thank you very much. We will see you again next week with more from the Middle East streams.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives adopted a package of internal rules that give right-wing hardliners more leverage over the chamber's newly elected Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. The House of Representatives on Monday, 9th of January, narrowly passed a package of rules governing its operations for the 118th Congress and laying out the Republican majority's priorities, fresh off a grueling speaker's election that spanned more than 4 days and ended on a historic 15th ballot. The package passed 220 to 213. With one Republican joining all Democrats against it. Republican Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas had publicly said ahead of the vote that he would not be voting for it. Republican Representative Dan Crenshaw of Texas did not vote. The 55-page proposal is the culmination of weeks of negotiations between newly elected Speaker Kevin McCarthy and a block of conservative lawmakers who withheld their support for his bid for the gavel until they were able to extract a series of concessions from the Republican leader. Those concessions have sparked concern from Democrats and even some Republicans and will significantly weaken Kevin McCarthy's leverage as Speaker. The new rules will also strengthen the position of members of the House Freedom Caucus. Fresh off a bruising speaker's election that spanned more than 4 days and ended on a historic 15th ballot, The House convened Monday evening to consider the package of rules governing its operations for the 118th Congress and laying out the new Republican majority's priorities. Representative Tony Gonzalez of Texas announced his opposition to the rules package ahead of the vote. A second representative, Nancy Mace of South Carolina, revealed on Sunday that she was on the fence about the proposal. In an interview with Face the Nation, Nancy Mace said she supported the rules package but took issue with the closed-door negotiations surrounding it that led the group of McCarthy's detractors to ultimately support his election or vote present. The South Carolina Republican also indicated that GOP lawmakers were not involved in the talks between McCarthy's leadership team and the conservative holdouts, have been left in the dark about what other promises he made. "We don't have any idea what promises were made or what gentlemen's handshakes were made. We just have no idea at this point," Nancy Mace said, "and it does give me quite a bit of heartburn." Democrats echoed that concern on the House floor on Monday. "What I'm concerned about is not just what's written down here. I'm concerned by the backroom deals that Speaker McCarthy made with the Freedom Caucus in exchange for their votes," Democratic Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts said, mentioning Nancy Mace's comments. "These rules are not a serious attempt at governing. They're essentially a ransom note to America from the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. The rules package at the heart of McCarthy's quest to become Speaker does include some of the concessions he made. Perhaps the most significant concession that Kevin McCarthy made in the rules package involves the motion to vacate the chair, a procedural tool used to remove the Speaker. The House rules under former Speaker Nancy Pelosi required a majority vote by a party caucus or conference in order for a motion to vacate to be brought up to a vote, and Kevin McCarthy initially lowered the threshold to force a vote down to 5 members. But in his effort to appease his conservative detractors, McCarthy eventually agreed to restore the ability of a single member from either party to force a vote to oust the Speaker of the House. The rules package calls for the House to take up a resolution establishing a select subcommittee on the weaponization of the U.S. federal government. The panel will be part of the House Judiciary Committee, which is expected to be led by Republican Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio. British newsletter The Guardian has also covered the story. The Republican-led U.S. House of Representatives on Monday, 9th of January, adopted a package of internal rules that give right-wing hardliners more leverage over the chamber's newly elected Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. Lawmakers voted 220 to 213 for the legislation, with only one Republican voting against. All 212 Democrats voted against the rules package, saying it was full of concessions to the right wing of the Republican Party. The rules package, which will govern House operations over the next 2 years, represented an early test of Kevin McCarthy's ability to keep his caucus together. After he suffered the humiliation of 14 failed ballots last week at the hands of 20 hardliners, before finally being elected Speaker on Saturday. The legislation includes key concessions that hardliners sought and Kevin McCarthy agreed to in his quest for the Speaker's gavel. The changes include allowing a single lawmaker to call for his removal at any time. Other changes would place new restrictions on federal spending, potentially limiting Kevin McCarthy's ability to negotiate government funding packages with President Joe Biden, whose fellow Democrats control the U.S. Senate. Democrats denounced the legislation as a rules package for MAGA extremists that would favor wealthy corporations over workers, undermine congressional ethics standards, and lead to further restrictions on abortion services. These rules are not a serious attempt at governing. They're essentially a ransom note to America from the extreme right wing of the Republican Party, Democratic Representative Jim McGovern said. Kevin McCarthy was hard at work on Capitol Hill on Monday prior to the House going into session, trying to head off any such revolt and ensure a smooth passage for the rules package later on that day. He can only afford to lose a handful of votes from his party in the House to avoid defeat on any measure. A clutch of establishment Republicans had indicated on Sunday they might withhold their support for the new rules package unless more details of Kevin McCarthy's concessions made to the right wing of the party are revealed, such as promising chairmanships of powerful committees that longer established and more moderate members have been eyeing. Pressure groups on Monday, 9th of January, stepped in to make clear there will be consequences if the first vote of McCarthy's speakership turns into a standoff. On Friday, hours before McCarthy formally was elected to the speakership, Texas Representative Tony Gonzalez said he would oppose the rules package, reportedly over McCarthy's willingness to cut spending to the Defense Department, the Pentagon. That prompted the conservative group Freedom Works on Monday to signal that Gonzalez should be frozen out if he rebels. The South Carolina moderate Republican Nancy Mace on Monday said she was on the fence. Speaking to CBS News on Sunday, Nancy Mace said, "On the fringe members who almost sank Kevin McCarthy's speakership bid last week," she said, "my question really is today, what backroom deals did they try to cut, and did they get those deals? We don't know what they got. We haven't seen it. We don't have any idea what gentlemen's handshakes were made. And it does give me a little bit of heartburn because that's not what we ran on." The package itself was published on Friday evening and includes a measure to allow a single member to force a motion to vacate the speakership, already weakening Kevin McCarthy's position. It also includes reinstating a provision to allow lawmakers to propose amendments to appropriations bills, adds a 72-hour window for members to read bills before they vote, and a commitment to vote on legislation on term limits for members of Congress.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Chinese President Xi Jinping hailed Beijing's solidarity with Iran as he hosted the Islamic Republic's President Ebrahim Raisi during the recent 3 days official visit. Some mainstream Western media outlets interpreted President Raisi's trip to the Asian giant as China and Iran huddling together for warmth. Such a view is not surprising to international observers, since it's a result of their binary opposition thinking and also because Washington distorts the view in the international landscape and through a distorted mirror, all things that the U.S. and the rest of the West see are twisted. However, it seems that America is underestimating the impact of China-Iran relations. In fact, many of the achievements of China-Iran cooperation in recent years have been realized by overcoming interference and sabotage by the U.S. side. It may be difficult to improve this situation presently, but there's a whole lively world outside the U.S.-West bloc and its circle of influence. Indeed, there's a huge space and potential for win-win cooperation between non-Western countries, including China and Iran, which cannot be blocked by the political forces of the U.S. and its cronies. As two ancient civilizations in Asia, China and Iran are complementary economically, and they both have strong ambitions for development. The development needs of China and Iran are compatible in many fields. In recent years, China has been a large trading partner, while Iran has been a significant energy producer, in addition to being one of the most important markets for China's exports. Furthermore, China is the target partner of Iran's Looking East policy, so the potential for future cooperation between the two sides is enormous. For an analysis, please stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. Contrary to the distorted narrative of the Western mainstream media, the development of China-Iran relations has a strong internal driving force. In that sense, President Raisi's state visit to China is very natural. Mr. Hariri is the chairman of Iran-China Chamber of Commerce and Industry. We made a trip to visit him at his office.
What message do you think President Raisi's recent trip to China conveys to the West?
The same message that was announced many times by the Chinese government, even in this visit, was emphasized by the president of China, that the U.S. cannot unilaterally impose restrictions on any country. The important message of this trip is the beginning of the end of the unilateral dominance of the United States in the political world, that China is transforming its role as a major economic power in the world in a very, very influential power in the field of diplomacy and global equations.
Of course, Iran is still under severe sanctions by the U.S., and China is the main target of U.S.'s strategic suppression. But with a petty mindset, some U.S. and Western public opinion appeared rather odd in viewing the relationship between China and Iran, hyping that both countries are opposed to the U.S. and claiming that cooperation between the two sides will weaken U.S. efforts to isolate Iran. Such zero-sum thinking is arrogant, unreasonable, and overbearing. As an old Chinese saying goes, how can a sparrow know the will of a swan?
Iran's relationship with any country at any level, in a situation where it is in a severe conflict with the West, especially the United States, and the cruel and crippling sanctions that the United States has imposed on Iran, would naturally cause them to start worrying. Well, China is the second largest economy in the world, as well as Russia, which has opposite interests with the West. Naturally, the relationship with this country is of great concern and importance for them, especially because these relations can actually make Iran come out of the trap of sanctions and be able to solve its economic problems through relations with China.
From both the perspective of history and reality, China and Iran have many similarities. As two civilizations with a long history, they had the experience of walking from ancient glory to being bullied in modern times. In the new era, both hold the goal and dream of rejuvenation and draw their lesson when exploring the path of modernization. That is, blindly copying Western systems does not work, while finding an approach that suits one's own condition is effective and prudent.
The nations of Iran and China date back to the time when they were empires in the world. People did trade in the Roman Empire, and cargoes would arrive to Iran as it was the center of the road from where the items would be distributed in two or three routes to China. Today, the traces of these interactions can still be seen in the western and central regions of China. That is, Chinese Muslims are generally converted to Islam by Iranian merchants. And you can see that, for example, in many cities in China, we see the poems of Ferdowsi, Saadi, or Hafez in Persian on the front of their mosques.
In this sense, China's deepening cooperation with Iran also has anti-hegemony and anti-bullying features. Both China and Iran uphold independent foreign policies, firmly defend the principles of non-interference in international affairs on international occasions, and safeguard the common interests of developing countries. To know more about the topic of today's Iran Today, we had an interview with Mr. Alipour, who's an analyst and had interesting points to share.
China is not only a trade partner, but has currently become also a strategic partner for Iran. What is your opinion on that?
The trip was carried out after the maximum sanctions of the United States and the West, which was actually based on the strategic approach of the 13th administration, based on the approach of looking to the East and cooperating with countries that have some kind of a special commercial and political capacity to cooperate with the Islamic Republic of Iran, which in a way conveyed this message to the Westerners that despite the sanctions they impose against the Islamic Republic of Iran, with the strategic approach adopted by the administration at the time, the sanctions that were imposed somehow failed, and we can escape from such special conditions through cooperation with China. We can advance this issue and somehow neutralize the sanctions.
This is conducive to promoting the multipolarization and diversified development of the world and conforms to the general trend of the times. If anyone feels targeted in this process, then they should first reflect on whether they are too self-serving.
You see, considering what is against us in the world and considering what has been intensified by the same factors in our society over the past few months, the differences that exist, the way the West plans to tell the story of instability of a government or an end to it, the official invitation of the Chinese president to the president of Iran after 23 years shows that the Chinese government, the Communist Party and the Chinese people, the Chinese governing establishment as a whole, consider Iran's role in global interactions and in regional equations to be a role that is effective and important, and if not the most important in the region, at least it's one of the most important players in the region, and the Chinese government is willing to maintain its relations with Iran at a high political and economic level.
The key takeaway of President Raisi's state visit to Beijing goes way beyond the signing of bilateral cooperation agreements, analysts say. It is viewed rather as a crucial turning point in a complex, decades-long historic process of Eurasia integration. The serious possibility of Iran-China finally configuring what will be a brand new expanded strategic economic space from East Asia to West Asia is central to 21st century multipolarity disposition and is a major geopolitical triumph.
President Raisi's visit to China, the first since he took office in August 2021, will accelerate the implementation of the 25-year agreement between the two countries, according to Chinese experts.
A review of the statistics and figures of the last 10 months in the calendar year of 1401, which began on March 21, indicates that the bilateral trade between the Islamic Republic of Iran and China, non-oil trade, of course, is about $25 billion, and the share of the export of the Islamic Republic of Iran is about $12.4 billion, which is a significant figure. I emphasize again that it's non-oil trade. Well, considering this issue, we should note that China is our most important trading partner.
This meeting between the two leaders will also guide bilateral cooperation to a higher level, underscoring the deepened mutual trust between the two countries despite geopolitical uncertainties. In 2016, President Xi visited Iran, leading to the signing of several memoranda of understanding and subsequently the wide-ranging 25-year comprehensive strategic agreement.
China is an investor country in the field of fossil energy such as oil and gas, and it has made the largest amount of investment that we can make use of. Another issue is related to high-speed trains. With China, significant technologies that are even ahead of the United States and Europe, which we can consider. Moreover, during our previous document, we had discussed the high-speed trains of Tehran-Mashhad and Tehran-Qom Isfahan in order to have cooperation. But unfortunately, it remained hamstring under the previous administration. Hopefully, we can pay attention to this issue under this document and use Chinese technologies.
China has always viewed and developed its relations with Iran from a strategic perspective, she said to Raisi during their meeting in Beijing, noting that no matter how the international and regional situation changes, China will unswervingly develop friendly cooperation with Iran, push for new development of the comprehensive strategic partnership, and play a positive role in world peace and human progress.
You see, the field of economics basically speaks for itself. It's not much involved in politics. Economies like the economy of Iran, economies whose main basis for trade with the world is the export of raw materials such as Iran and Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, these are the ones we see in our own region. With economies like China, which are the biggest buyers of energy and raw materials. And from that side, they are the biggest exporter of machinery and technology to the world. And countries like us, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, these are the biggest buyers of these items. So they are naturally partners. This is the nature of their economy.
According to Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Diplomacy, Mehdi Safari, there are several factors that influence the strategic perspective of China to work with Iran and vice versa. Firstly, Iran has 2,200 kilometers of coastline in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman that includes the Strait of Hormuz. China has 6.5 million barrels of oil passing through this area.
For China, the most important issue in this region of the world is to establish a smooth flow of energy and raw materials to China. China supplies a significant part of its imported energy, whether in the form of oil, gas, or condensate, from the Persian Gulf region. And if on a predictable day, as all political and economic analysts in the world predict that there will be a conflict between the US and China in the Asia-Pacific region, if we assume this happens, which anyway is considered by Chinese academies as an assumption that is a day when it's possible for the US to tell Saudi Arabia that you have no right to sell oil to China, and Saudi Arabia would follow suit. But no one can tell Iran who to sell to and who not to sell to.
As much as energy is important, its security is vital. In Safari's view, China realizes that a powerful country like the Islamic Republic of Iran provides the security for the energy that passes through the Persian Gulf region. So this is one aspect of the strategic partnership for Iran-China relations.
Energy from the Persian Gulf region must pass through the Straits of Hormuz, Malaga, and Taiwan to reach Chinese ports. All the southern parts of these straits, namely the Strait of Hormuz, the Strait of Malaga, and the Taiwan Strait, are under the control of American bases. So it's possible that all these straits will be the place to disrupt China's energy path. There are two countries in the world that have enough resources and reserves of energy, and they can connect to China by land, and those two countries are Iran and Russia.
Secondly, Iran has the advantage of neighboring 15 other countries, and that's added value. Thirdly, Iran has energy. In addition to providing energy security, Iran can also provide energy. And the fourth has to do with Iran's geography and its potential for One Belt and Road Initiative. There are several corridors that could pass through Iran, forming a geostrategic China-Iran economic corridor.
In particular, we can pay attention to three issues and components as the achievement of Mr. Raisi's recent trip. The most important issue is the political will of the parties, who at the highest level expressed their political will based on bilateral and even multilateral cooperation in the form of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which can be the most special achievement of the trip. In addition, about 20 cooperation documents were signed under the comprehensive 25-year cooperation document, which brought this document into the implementation phase and somehow activated the deal. Another significant issue is cooperation in the form of the Belt and Road mega project. The Chinese send about 50,000 trains to Europe every year. And if we can move about 5,000 trains to our country from the number of trains that are sent to Europe, we can have the discussion of employment and the interlinking of the components such as economic and commercial cooperation.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media.
Here's how it looks on the page. Atlantic Council reads, China-Iran relations are warming. Here's what the rest of the world should know. What was China's aim in hosting such a high-profile visit from the Iranian president? I suspect a part of this reception is relationship repair after Xi's visit to Riyadh in December. When he last visited Saudi Arabia in 2016, he stopped in Iran on the way home. This time, not only was there no Iran visit, but the joint communique of the China Gulf Cooperation Council summit featured language that indicated Beijing's support for the United Arab Emirates' position in its long-standing dispute with Iran over the Greater and Lesser Tombs and Abu Musa, islands near the Strait of Hormuz. This resulted in a lot of angry commentary from Iranians who questioned China's commitment to the country and the government's ability to manage its most important bilateral relationship. Raisi's visit likely is a means of restoring a bit of balance to China's presence in the Gulf. Raisi's trip to Beijing is likely meant to show Iranians that their country is not as isolated as it appears. Despite protests and an economy devastated by sanctions, the Islamic Republic still has a great power partner it can rely on. According to Reuters, China-Iran call for Iran sanctions to be lifted, Xi to visit. China's President Xi Jinping and his Iranian counterpart Ebrahim Raisi called for the lifting of sanctions on Iran as an integral part of a stalled international agreement on its nuclear program. Xi also accepted an invitation from Raisi to visit Iran and would do so at his convenience, the two leaders said in a joint statement on the last day of a three-day state visit to China by Raisi. Xi last visited Iran in 2016 as part of a tour of the Middle East. The leaders in their statement called for the implementation of the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, under which Iran agreed with several countries, including the United States, to curb its nuclear program in return for economic sanctions relief. APN News says, China and Iran have urged mutual neighbor Afghanistan to end restrictions on women's work and education. The call came in a joint statement on February 16, issued at the close of a visit to Beijing by Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, during which the two sides affirmed close economic and political ties and the rejection of Western standards of human rights and democracy. Since taking over Afghanistan in August 2021, the Taliban has banned women and girls from universities and schools after the sixth grade and forced out those in elected offices and other prominent positions. The two sides called on the Afghan rulers to form an inclusive government in which all ethnic groups and political groups actually participate and cancel all discriminatory measures against women, ethnic minorities, and other religions, the statement said, adding that the U.S. and its NATO allies should be responsible for the current situation in Afghanistan. Last year, Iran and China began the implementation phase of a 25-year cooperation accord, as part of which China is to invest billions of dollars in Iran's petroleum sector in exchange for the supply of oil and petrochemical products.
Perhaps the most special issue regarding China is that, unfortunately, there is a kind of xenophobia in the media and some friends who write about China. In fact, we should practice realism in relation to the discussion of commercial cooperation with China. Yes, it's true, commercial and political cooperation. But it's good that we do not interpret China in a way that causes a kind of fear of China to be created, and that the opportunities that exist will be missed again, and that the country will be in difficulty.
According to Mohammad Marandi, a professor at the University of Tehran and a political analyst, whoever studies the text of the 25-year partnership agreement will understand that this document benefits our country. When this document was signed in Iran, some opposed it, but when other countries in the Persian Gulf or in other places signed similar agreements with China, the same critics commended them, adding that Iran's strategic partnership agreement is the strongest deal the regional countries have ever clinched with Beijing. Iran's opponents and Western media high sensitivity to the deal further proves that it is a very useful deal for the Islamic Republic. The deal sets the outlines of cooperation in political, cultural, security, defense, regional, and international domains for the next 25 years. During their latest meeting, the two Iranian and Chinese heads of state both emphasized a rejection of unilateralism, hegemony, and foreign interference in the domestic affairs of Iran. The sides are expected to increase coordination under multilateral platforms such as the UN and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and inject positive energy to regional and global peace.
According to the available figures, until the years before the coronavirus outbreak, the Chinese made about 200 million foreign trips every year. And through these 25